Well, hello everyone, and welcome to what is actually our third Tech Talk on the subject of core knowledge in the CCIE Route Switch Lab exam. My name is Anthony Sequeira, and today in this Tech Talk, we're going to continue our discussion. This will be part two of a discussion of some of the basics of OSPF, certainly information that we would consider part of our core knowledge for the Open Shortest Path First protocol. I want to shout out a welcome to all of our WINE live listeners. I can see we get quite a few people listening live this afternoon, and we hope you enjoyed the programming over the last 24 hours where we played albums that were so great they had to be played in their entirety. I want to pick up in this particular Tech Talk on OSPF with the discussion of our router types. Let's review the types of routers that we can have in OSPF. And an important thing to remember about our router types is that you can certainly have a router fulfilling more than one router type. Remember, if all interfaces belong within a single area, or within the same area, we have an internal router. So we could have an internal router in the backbone. All of its interfaces are participating in the backbone area, area zero. And in this case, we have what is called an internal router, and it's also a backbone router. If at least one interface touches area zero, the backbone, we have a backbone router, and if all of the interfaces are in a particular area, we have what's called an internal router. So right off the bat, we see how a router can have multiple router type designations. Now, if your router connects one area to another area, it's an area border router. And we remember that you have a separate link state database for each of the areas that your area border router connects to. There's another type of router out there. We've covered internal routers, we've covered backbone routers, we've covered area border routers. Do you remember what another type of router is in OSPF? Once again, we've talked about internal, area border routers, and backbone routers. What is the other type of OSPF router we can run into? Yeah, great job. It's an autonomous system boundary router, or ASBR. The ASBR's job is to inject routes into the OSPF network that we learn from another routing protocol. We might place this router anywhere, so this router could be a backbone router, it could be an ABR, but it's a special router, the autonomous system boundary router, whose job is to take external prefixes and bring them into the OSPF domain. Now, after you study these different OSPF router types, it's perfect timing to go ahead and study your types of LSAs, link state advertisements, that we have in OSPF. We should be familiar with several types of LSAs for the core knowledge section, as well as the configuration section of your exam. We want to focus on LSA types 1 through 5 and 7. Probably the first thing that you want to do is make some flashcards to memorize for a particular type designation. What is the description that is used in the RFCs? For instance, a type 1 LSA we call a router LSA. A type 2, we term a network LSA. Type 3, a network summary LSA. Type 4, an ASBR summary LSA. Type 5 is an AS external LSA. And a type 7 is an NSSA external. That's for not so stubby area. Once you master those descriptions, you'll have a lot better time of remembering exactly what the purpose of the LSA is. For instance, a Type 1 or router LSA lists all of the router's links and their state. We refer to this as the fundamental building block LSA in OSPF. These LSA types flood within the area where they originated. A type 2 LSA is called a network LSA, and it's produced by the designated router on each multi-access network. These LSAs list all the attached routers, including the designated router itself, and once again, they flood within the originating area. Our Type 3 LSA is the Network Summary LSA. This LSA type is originated by our area border routers, and it's sent into an area in order to advertise destinations outside the area. These Type 3 Network Summary ABRs are flooded throughout the entire autonomous system. A Type 4 is the ASBR Summary. We know what it does because we studied the ASBR a moment earlier. This is also originated by the area border router, and it's a destination that is advertising the ASBR's presence. So this is the address, if you will, of the autonomous system boundary router, and this is flooded through the autonomous system as well. Our Type 5 is the AS external, and these are the prefixes originated by the autonomous system boundary routers that advertise external destinations. These, by default, flood throughout our autonomous system. And then finally, we have the not-so-stubby external Type 7 LSA type. It is originated by the autonomous system boundary router of a not-so-stubby area. OSPF uses routing designators in the routing table in order to distinguish between types of routes. The designators used by OSPF can be seen with the show IP route command. For instance, just the O designation indicates an OSPF intra-area, a router LSA entry. So networks from within the same area of the router are going to show up with the O designation in the routing table. If we see O space IA, this indicates an inter-area summary LSA. As we remember, these are networks outside of the area of our router, but within the same autonomous systems. And Type 3 LSAs are used to create these OIA entries. If we see an OE1 designation in the routing table, we know this is a Type 1 external route. Networks outside of the autonomous system show up as these Type 5 LSAs. If it's a Type 1, we calculate the cost by adding the external cost to the internal cost of each link that the packet crosses. Why might we want to set a Type 1 external? Well, if we've got multiple ASBRs advertising the external route, then we want the cost to be additive in this nature. We want the cost to be the external cost plus the cost of each link in RAS. An OE2 designation, which is the default type for externals on our Cisco routers, is again going to be advertising networks outside of our AS, and this is done with Type 5 LSAs, but the cost of the OE2 route is always just the external cost only. Routers in OSPF share an identical link state database with other routers in the same area. We know that. And we know that Area 0 is reserved for the backbone area. The backbone is responsible for summarizing each area to every other area. We configure a router for the backbone by placing an interface in Area 0 using the network command. So when we take a look at our OSPF configuration and we see an interface or interfaces that are in area zero, we just configured this device to be a backbone router. Now, another type of area that we need to be familiar with in OSPF is the stub area. A stub area is going to block those external LSAs. That's the Type 4 advertising the ASPR and the Type 5 advertising the external prefixes. Remember, with a stub router, adjacencies will not form with any other router that's not marked as stub. Remember when we were talking in the last session about that stub flag? That stub flag setting in the hello packets needs to match in order for an adjacency to form. Another rule we need to remember about the stub area is that virtual links can't be configured within a stub area. Do you remember the command that you use to create a stub? It's real simple. In router configuration mode for OSPF, you're going to use the command area, followed by the area ID you want to make stub, and then the simple keyword, stub. I'm very short. Back in elementary school, I was always teased and I was called totally stubby. Little did I know back then that that is another type of OSPF area. The totally stubby area. Not only is it going to block out those Type 4 and 5 LSAs, but it's also going to block our summary, our Type 3 LSAs. The only exception to this is a single Type 3 default LSA. That's right, we need a default route injected into the totally stubby area so that it can reach all these external destinations. We configure a totally stubby area by using the area ID stub command we used earlier, but on the ABR, we just add the keyword no-summary. That's right, the no-summary keyword is only going to be needed on the area border router. We can change the cost of the default route sent into the totally stubby area using the command area ID, default-cost. Another type of area we've already mentioned in today's presentation is the not-so-stubby area. The not-so-stubby area does allow external routes to leak in, and they come in as Type 7 LSAs. An area border router for the not-so-stubby area will take these Type 7 LSAs and translate them into the good old-fashioned Type 5 LSAs and send them into the rest of the OSPF domain. In order to configure the not-so-stubby area, we use the area ID, NSSA command. The area NSSA command is used on all the routers in the area. And notice that we're using it basically in place of the area stub command. One of the configuration areas you need to be aware of with OSPF is the OSPF router ID. The router ID is how all of the OSPF speakers are going to be identified in OSPF. This router ID is also used to break a tie for the DR-BDR election. This is especially true when the administrator has not set the OSPF priority values. Remember, we can set the OSPF priority values to rig this election by using the OIP OSPF priority command. Boy, that was tough for me to say. Still kind of early for me. I don't get started until about 3 p.m. Eastern Standard United States time. So we use the IPOSPF priority command in order to rig this DR-BDR election. Now, if we don't rig the election using priority, the router with the highest router ID is going to win the election. You see, the router ID we can set with the router ID router configuration command. If we're using this command after OSPF has selected a router ID, we need to clear the IPOSPF process in order to reset it. Now, the router ID, if we failed to set it with the router ID command, it's going to grab the highest IP address on any of your loopback interfaces. If you don't have a loopback interface, well, then it's going to look at the highest IP address on any of your active interfaces. We can use show IPOSPF in order to verify what was selected on our device for router ID. We also want to be aware of how to summarize routes in OSPF. And what's interesting is there's two ways to do it. This is in contrast to like Border Gateway Protocol or EIGRP or RIP version 2. In OSPF, we have inter-area summarization. This is performed on our area border routers. And we have external route summarization, which is performed typically on our autonomous system boundary router. So to configure inter-area route summarization, we use the area range syntax in router configuration mode. But to summarize external routes on the ASBR, we use the summary-address syntax. One of the things that is interesting about the summary-address command is there's a not-advertise optional keyword, and this is going to suppress routes that match the specified prefix. What about advertising a default route in OSPF? For an OSPF router to advertise a default route into an area, we use the command default information originate. If the advertising router does not possess a default route in its routing table, we can use the always keyword in order to still generate this default route. If you don't specify a metric for the default route, what is used? Well, a default metric of 10 is used. And we can always use the metric type keyword to specify whether we want one of those type 1 or type 2 external routes. When we're using the default information originate command, we can also specify a route map option. And this lets us control the generation of the default route even further. For example, if the default route is to be generated based on a condition in the route map being satisfied, we can configure it with this route map addition. What about authentication in OSPF? Well, this is pretty tricky. It's tricky because we have clear text or null authentication, or MD5 authentication. So there's three options for OSPF authentication. There's null, don't do any authentication. There's clear text, which really isn't a security mechanism. It's really more of a safeguard against misconfigurations. And then there's MD5. So you've got three different options when it comes to OSPF authentication. And to make this even more complex, in OSPF, there's two different ways on a Cisco router to set up authentication. We can set it up on an area basis, not mentioned in the RFCs on OSPF, by the way, or we can set it up on a link-by-link basis. Let's say that we want to set up clear text, also known as type 1 authentication, on our devices, and we want to do it on an area basis. In router configuration mode, we would use the area authentication syntax. And then we would go to the interface and we would specify the clear text password with IP OSPF authentication hyphen key. If we wanted to do type 2 MD5, again on an area basis, under router configuration mode, you would use your area authentication command and set it to message digest, and then under the interface, you would use IP OSPF message digest key, your key value, the keyword MD5, and your password. Now, the big difference when you're setting up authentication on the link basis is we don't have a router configuration command. You are specifying the type of authentication you're doing under the interface, as well as your shared secret or password under the interface. We should also review how OSPF calculates cost. The cost is the metric used by OSPF, and it's directly calculated from the interface's bandwidth, as you've reported with the bandwidth command. The cost equals a reference bandwidth value divided by bandwidth. The default reference bandwidth is 100 megabits per second. So the bandwidth we've configured with the bandwidth command is going to be divided into the 100 megabit per second reference bandwidth to give us our cost value. So if we use many interfaces that are faster than that 100 megabits per second, we might want to reset the reference bandwidth value. This is to give granularity in the decision-making process between these very high-speed links. We remember that this is done with the auto cost reference bandwidth command. And our reference bandwidth is in megabits per second. So for example, if we wanted to ensure a gigabit Ethernet interface evaluates to a cost of 5, we'd set the reference bandwidth on each router to 5,000. We can also override whatever cost was calculated for a particular interface using the IP OSPF cost command. Some additional interface parameters you want to be aware of when it comes to OSPF include things like the IP OSPF retransmit interval. This is specifying the number of seconds between LSA retransmissions. We have the IP OSPF transmit delay, which sets the number of seconds required to send a link state update. There's IP OSPF hello interval, obviously straightforward, the time between hello packets. And there's the IP OSPF dead interval, the number of seconds before a router is considered dead. Notice that in OSPF, the hello interval and the dead intervals must match in order for adjacencies to form. Now, administrative distance is interesting with OSPF. There's three different values possible. We have intra-area routes, inter-area routes, and external routes. By default, all are set to 110, but we can change them with the router configuration command distance, OSPF, intra-area, inter-area, or external. So, while they all start out at 110, we can manipulate the administrative distances for intra-area, inter-area, or external. Remember what passive interface will do in OSPF. Passive interface prevents an interface from sending hello packets and will prevent an adjacency from forming. Notice it also, of course, prevents the sending or receiving of routing information through the interface. So the interface ends up appearing as a stub network in the OSPF domain. We have our route calculation timers that can be set in OSPF. This is the delay between when a topology change is received and when an SPF calculation takes place. We can also configure the hold time between two consecutive SPF calculations. And all of this is done with the timers SPF command. We can also manipulate the LSA group pacing. Routers group LSAs and pace the refreshing, checksumming, and aging functions so that the resource strain on the router is reduced. We can tweak this behavior using the timers LSA-group-pacing command. Something else we can manipulate for OSPF is the blocking of that LSA flooding behavior. We can prevent this default flooding. And to do this on a broadcast, non-broadcast, or point-to-point network, we use the interface configuration command OSPF database-filter all out. On a point-to-multipoint network, we use the command neighbor IP address database-filter all out. Another advanced OSPF manipulation we can make is to reduce LSA flooding. We can reduce the flooding in stable topologies by setting LSAs to do not age. We configure this with an interface configuration command called IP OSPF flood-reduction. Remember what a virtual link is in OSPF. We really have a band-aid with the virtual link. Whenever we have an area that is not touching the backbone, or we have a section of area zero that has become disconnected, we can use a virtual link through an area to fix this. We create a virtual link with the area virtual link syntax in router configuration mode. And it's very important to remember that when we create virtual links, we are using the router ID on the two devices. So it's router ID that is used in the virtual link command. And something that I found very interesting when I was initially studying this, I found it completely surprising to be honest, is that the router ID that you reference in the virtual link command does not have to be an advertised or reachable from a routing table perspective router ID value. So very interesting. It's just the router ID will get it done. And that does not have to be an IP address that you've advertised. Another interesting feature in OSPF is the on-demand circuit enhancement. With the on-demand OSPF enhancement, periodic hellos are suppressed, and the periodic refreshes of LSAs are not flooded over the demand circuit. So these types of packets bring up the link only the first time or when we have a topology change that needs to be propagated. We can configure this on a per interface basis with the command IP OSPF demand hyphen circuit. An RFC that we want to be familiar with for OSPF is RFC 3623, and this defines the OSPF graceful restart capability. This feature gets incorporated into Cisco routers thanks to the non-stop forwarding capability. And non-stop forwarding is not just engineered into OSPF, but also BGP, EIGRP, and ISIS. The idea here is to allow the router to continue forwarding packets even while it's undergoing some specific well-known failure condition. Maybe we're upgrading software, or maybe one of the multiple route processors has crashed. Before RFC 3623, Cisco offered a proprietary version of non-stop forwarding. Cisco now refers to this version as Cisco NSF. The OSPF RFC 3623 graceful restart feature enables you to configure the non-vendor specific, the non-proprietary non-stop forwarding. Cisco now tends to refer to this as simply IETF NSF. Understand that NSF operates in one of two modes when it comes to failover operations. The first possible mode is called restarting mode. In restarting mode, the OSPF router process performs non-stop forwarding recovery because of a route processor switchover. The second possible mode is helper mode. In helper mode, a neighboring router restarts, and the helper mode router assists in the non-stop forwarding recovery process. While all this is pretty complex and exciting, the configuration is very straightforward. Enabling the IETF NSF on a Cisco router involves the NSF IETF command. So, more great information, or at least I hope you find this has been great information to review regarding OSPF before we would ever consider sitting down at our core knowledge section. We'll be back on WINE Radio real soon with more great core knowledge reviews for you on Cisco Technologies.